Yeah.
And the reason why that happens is because it's the same mechanism. You're creating an emotional association with the amount of time you've been thinking about her, and your brain doesn't know that this is fake. It just goes, I've been spending this much time on this person, and therefore I must be in a relationship with them. And so you start to feel those feelings, you start to talk to her like that, and eventually you scare her off because you're too needy, right?
Right.
And that happens. That's one of the reasons why a lot of guys can date, you know, pretty good-looking or good-looking girls, but then when it comes to women that they're really hot for, really attractive women, they tend to not know what to do, or they tend to blow it at the last second.
Right.
Because they sort of, you know, in a sense of like poker, they sort of show their hand instead of just playing like they always do and having a fun time.
Right, so. Right. They step out of their normal... They step out of the normal kind of mindset for having just met somebody into something based more in emotional fantasy building. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So
let's kind of, so now we're on the date. You're on the patio. You're smoking the hookah. You're having the glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are you looking for on a first date? Like, what kind of information are you looking for? What kind of experience are you looking to have? You know, kind of talk to us about the conversation at the table. You know, what goes on there, and what your mindset is talking to a woman on a first date.
Sure. So, in an initial interaction, whatever the initial interaction was, typically it was out at a bar or something, or I met her somewhere, sort of out. Or, you know, I met a lot of women, I dated a lot of women that were working at bars and stuff too. And typically when I met her the first time, I would run through a series of sort of mindsets, sort of phases of the interaction. You know, and these are pretty common phases. Everyone goes through these. We just probably don't think about them as much. Or some people don't. You probably do, Stephen, because you've been studying this for a long time too and practicing. So, but I would go through in really quick succession. I would go through curiosity, creation, like sparks and like teasing, kind of fun. To,
right.
To like a spurt of deep sort of revealing, just like lifting back the curtain a little bit to show there's some real substance to me and that I'm not all just jokey and fun and silly. And then there's the powerful, seductive sort of I go after what I want and I desire part of me that I show. And I show these all in pretty quick succession. I mean, maybe it takes 10 minutes to see all three of these, you know. Maybe sometimes 15, but pretty fast. And once I get through this there, I basically take that entire process and I stretch it out over the allotted amount of time that I think that I have with the girl later. So on the date, if I think I'm going to be able to talk to this girl for 10 minutes, I cram everything into that 10 minutes. I go, you know, 3 minutes of curiosity, 3 minutes of, you know, 4 minutes of rapport, 3 minutes of being a powerful man, you know. And that's what I do, roughly. I never, you know, timed it or anything. I wasn't like looking at my watch. But if I thought that she was going to be gone soon, I would take the initiative. And so what I did is I would take that same sort of thought process and I would stretch it out over how much time I felt like I had that night. So the in the beginning, the conversation would always be very fun, lighthearted, kind of like what stuff that you were talking about before, where you're like, dress warm because there will be outdoor activities, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Really playful, banter line kind of stuff, jokes or like things that happened to me that were funny that we can laugh at.
Right.
It was all, you know, I was very revealing. I believe that if you laugh in front of a girl so much, trust just gets built immediately. Because she knows that you're not afraid to show that emotion. And I used to tell these, you know, I believe that if you can't tell a girl you've just met the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you, then there's something wrong.
Huh.
You should be able to tell her the most embarrassing thing that you ever has ever happened to you. And you should be able to tell it in a way that you laugh and she laughs. The end.
Right.
You know? And what that was a really common topic. I mean, I'll tell you my most embarrassing thing, Stephen, so you can.
Yeah, let's.
let's go there.
Let's all laugh.
So this, you know, it's not that bad knowing it now, but at the time it was really bad. I was a little kid. I was a couple actually. but one I can think of, the first one, the G-rated one, is this one. I was a little kid. I was in the lunchroom and I had chocolate milk. Because they used to do that, you know. They don't do that anymore,
yeah.
Apparently.
Right.
A little carton of milk. And, you know, you have to shake the carton of milk up, these little tiny cartons, so it'll get mixed, and then you drink it. It's chocolate milk. Otherwise, it's all, you know, chocolate's all at the bottom. It's gross. So I was a little kid. I'm talking to somebody. I must have been in second grade. I open my milk, I start drinking it, it's chocolate milk. Because they give you an option. I don't know what they were thinking. They give you an option to get chocolate milk or regular milk. Like, who's
right.
going to get regular milk? What second grader is going to get regular milk when there's an option for chocolate milk, really?
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I started drinking, and I realized, oh, crap, this is chocolate milk. And so I'm talking to somebody, and I don't close it, and I start to shake it.
Oh, no. All over you.
Where was I, or how old?
It was all over you, I'm sure.
It was all over me. Absolutely. It went everywhere. The first thing is I poured it straight down my shoulder and my back. And then I lifted it up and I started shaking before I realized what was going on. And it went just all over my face and everything was brown. I had a white shirt on. And then all the kids, like seemingly in unison, all turn and point. And it's like, ha, 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 ha. You know, like, that's how I remember it, at least. It was like a,
slow motion, probably.
Yeah, exactly, slow motion pointing. Like, you know that scene in the Christmas story where it's like a... Ho, 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 he gets kicked in the head by Santa Claus.
That's
how it was for me. So it was like, you know, they're all pointing and laughing, and, you know, it's like they're all close-up faces, and they're laughing at me. And I was like, oh, I just started bawling, you know, and I leave everything that's mine in the lunchroom, and I start running through the hallway. And I've never been in the hallway by myself because I was in second grade. So I start running through this maze of halls, like, I didn't know where the hell I was going, and I'm crying, and I finally find a corner, and I'm just sitting there balled up in a little ball, crying, and the dean or somebody at the school finds me and goes, "What is wrong with you? Let me get you," and brings me in, and then, you know, they give me a towel, and I'm like too embarrassed to go back to class, and, you know, call my mom, and she talks to me, and I go back to school after that. You know, it wasn't a big deal, but it was the most embarrassing thing forever. You know, and I realized that I hadn't told anybody that story since it had happened until I realized that it was the most embarrassing thing that I'd ever experienced at the time. And then I started like, well, I should really tell somebody this, you know, and just sort of get it off my chest. And I really encourage, you know, I really encourage everyone, you know, to think about what their most embarrassing moment was and really tell somebody and learn to laugh about it, because it, when you say your most embarrassing moment in front of someone you just met, it just lightens everything up.
It opens it wide open. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so much easier to be able to talk about that. So in the beginning, I would talk about stuff like that. My other story, I'll tell you some other time, Stephen. The other story is more of a traumatic experience, so I would start with stuff like that, sort of lighthearted, like you know, most embarrassing moment kind of stories, and then I would go into really deep, strong connection. And my goal from this date was always the rapport. The rapport is the goal. I love that space. I love being able to transfer emotion from one person to another. It's a phenomenal and really magical experience. And just like any other psychology, there's a reason why it happens, and there's a way to do it right. And you speak very eloquently on this topic too, on the concept and the theories behind rapport and how you sort of, what your take is and how you come across. You're a very emotionally charged person, Stephen. I mean, I get that from the way that you talk.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very sort of logically charged.
Right.
So,
right.
So, you know, again, in personality typing, they would say that you're a feeler and I'm a thinker. And feelers have an insane ability to connect with people. Just like, not everyone does it, but they have this insane ability to be able to look at someone and just say their emotions and be really in touch with them, because they make decisions based on their emotions, right?
Mm.
And I don't, naturally. I make decisions based on what, you know, logic, which I guess everyone thinks they do, but not everybody does. So,
right.
So in this case, this kind of works against me. You know, I know that there's a system to it, but following the system isn't always a good thing, you know? You really need, I really have to teach people to learn the system, to building rapport, and then sort of let go of it, and just go with what they feel, you know? But I can kind of breeze over if you'd like to hear a little bit about it.
Absolutely, because that's my next, I know that you spend a lot of time studying that, and you focus on it a lot, and things that you write about and talk about, and I would absolutely love to have your Cliff Notes mm-hmm. take on it, by all means, please, yeah. And particularly within the confines of a first date, you know,
sure.
maybe you've just been talking for 20 to 30 minutes with somebody. So what happens then?
Well, I think that the most important skill that someone can learn is what I call seeing the matrix. And I'm not sure if anyone else calls it that, but that's what I call it.
It's cool.
And the idea is that you recognize what state you're in at the moment that you're in it. You know, like you realize, holy crap, this is rapport. You know, I'm building rapport right now. This is me opening up, and this is what it feels like. You know, and being aware that you're doing it while you're doing it allows you a lot of freedoms. It allows you to recognize that things are happening, so you can say, okay, well, things are headed in this direction, so you can say, well, I want to go to here, and here's where I am, so now I can draw a map, right? So that's kind of the point behind seeing the matrix in the first place. Now, what you need now is where you want to go and how to get there, right? Once you know that and you can sort of see what stage you're in, then you can make pretty much anything you want happen. At that point. That's sort of the ultimate control, and that's what this used to be the focal point of my entire curriculum, was just this idea, the idea that there's a system to attracting people, and in the stages of rapport, these were all borrowed from sales, actually. You can imagine, in sales there's a bunch of people who are getting paid to build rapport with people and close a deal, right, and they figured out there's a system to rapport, and all I had to do was sort of take it from there and make it a little bit more applicable to dating, and it made sense still, because it's how people are. So basically there are a few different stages to rapport. The first stage that you're in is kind of the light area, where things are open and you're not committed to anything. Most of us sort of live in this light rapport stage. It's like you're testing to see if they're going to open up first or you're going to open up first.
Right.
The second stage is where you find something that you can probably connect on. So you're like, oh, aha, I got that thing. You know, we can talk about this or whatever. Usually that happens very quickly, and then guys jump into it immediately. And then the third stage is making that emotional transfer, because rapport at the end of the day is not just talking about something that you feel about or feel like or that you love. It's about transferring emotion from you to them and from them to you. It's a two-way street, so it's very important that you're open to them as well. And then the final stage of rapport is letting go of that thread altogether and starting it all over again. And every time you cycle through this stage, these different stages of rapport, you create a stronger bond, and this is what creates love. So when someone says, I love you, but I'm not in love with you, it means they have rapport for you, but they don't have sexual and logical attraction, which are two other areas of sort of consummate or true love.
Gotcha.
It's one of another psychologist's sort of theory of Robert Sternberg, who's a brilliant psychologist for relationships. And he had this triangular theory of love, and rapport is one of the areas, one of the corners of the triangle, but it's not all of them. So it creates love, but it doesn't mean that she's going to be in love with you. But it does create that really strong connection that people call love. Like, I love my brother, I love my family, that kind of thing, you know?
Right.
Once you understand that there's a system, and you go through, there are a few tools that you can use to help you sort of push things forward. One is, and I believe this is the most powerful tool, and it's called the I perspective. And the I perspective is like the letter I, or, you know, me, I.
Right, yeah.
And what we do is we accidentally default to what's called the you perspective, where we try to, we say something that is, we really mean I. We really mean, you know, whenever I go to the store, I look at the cereal and I get really excited and I want to get Cap'n Crunch. Right?
Right.
Even though it cuts the roof of my mouth. That's the I perspective. But we don't say that, though, when we're building rapport with people. You know what we say? We say, you know, when you go to the store and you see the cereal aisle and you see Cap'n Crunch and you're really excited and you want to get it. It's like that. You know?
Right.
And what people are doing is they're going, the whole time that someone says, you know, whenever you blah, 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 to me, I'm going, do I? Do I really do that? Is that really how I feel?
Right.
So instead of receiving this emotion from them, I'm sitting there questioning whether or not what they're saying is valid. And you can't be logical and emotional at the same time. It doesn't work like that. Your brain has a limited amount of resources, and it pulls on whatever's available. So if you're using your logical brain, you're not using your emotional brain very well. And vice versa. If you're using your emotional brain, it's really hard to be logical. We've all made mistakes like that before, you know? And so this imbalance, when you make a girl start to question and wonder whether or not what you're saying is valid or logically relevant, then she cannot be emotional. She cannot open up. And so instead of... The reason why we do this, though, is because we want her to open up first. We want her to say, yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. And then we go, oh, cool, it's just like that. All right, I didn't have to put my neck out there this time. You know, I didn't have to reveal anything until the very end, until she revealed something first. And that's really what we're doing. And we don't even see this what we're doing. What we have to do as men is it's our responsibility to open up and become vulnerable first, because if you truly are a powerful man, then you will be able to open up and be vulnerable to attack, because you are not afraid of attack, because you know how to handle it. Mm-hmm. And you did, since you did Kung Fu for a while, I don't know if you know this about me, Stephen, but I did Shaolin training for 6 years at a temple.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if I told you that or not. And that the scariest stance in Kung Fu is the one where they're inviting you to come hit them, always. Like, they're wide open. They're saying, come here, you know. Like, and it's scary, man. And you don't,
yeah.
I never liked fighting people like that, because I knew they're going to kick my ass.
Right.
You know? And it's kind of the same way when it comes to social interaction and connection. If you open up first, people respect you more. People attack you less if you open up first.
Mm.
And you can open up first by just something as simple as using the I perspective instead of saying you. It's a really simple technique, and it works wonders, really. There's lots of other things you can do, too, but that's really the cream of the crop there. I mean, that's the best, most high-value thing you can do in the shortest period of time.
Very cool, yeah. Very cool. And, yeah, the last thing you want to do is put somebody in a position of questioning or in their heads, particularly a woman. And I love the idea, too, about the simple idea about laughing, you know, on the early side of the date, you know, trying to show that, and trying to kind of, it does do something, and it establishes a strong sense of trust. I totally agree.
Right.
A couple of other questions here, because we're running a little short on time, but the first one is, the first kiss, let's imagine you've not had the kiss yet, maybe when you met her, and that you know, you want to kiss her, and that this is obviously your first date, so there's a logical meaning to doing that on this particular time with her. What would be, do you have a way that you do that? Do you try to structure it in beforehand? Or do you just totally kind of feel it in the moment and go for it?
Funny you should ask that. I have something I've done. Once I figured it out, I did it. I don't know how many times I've done this. It's worked. I mean, I want to give it a percentage, but I can't. I've had it not work one time out of every single time I've done it. And it's a series of just like a couple things I have to recognize first. And then once I see them, these cues, it means this girl really wants to kiss me. But I used to just look for those cues and hope that they would happen. But eventually I figured out how to make those cues happen. This is really cool. And so I figured out how to get a girl to make those cues. And when she made those cues, then I moved forward. And it was as if she did it on her own.
Mm.
As if she just wanted to kiss me the whole time. Maybe she did, but she just didn't show me. So I found that almost a totally trustworthy way of telling whether or not a girl wants to kiss you is whether or not she's looking at your mouth when you're talking.
Hmm.
This is pretty straightforward. I mean, there's something called triangular gazing or triangulating.
Right.
Where someone looks at your, you know, left eye and your right eye, and then down at your mouth and back up at your eyes and down at your mouth for a while. And when they do this, they're sort of connecting with you through your eyes, and then thinking about kissing you and looking at your mouth and really getting drawn to it, usually.
Mm, right.
So what I found is that, and you probably will notice this too, if you actually do it to someone else, they will mirror you and do that back to you. It's so often that it happens, and usually what I would do is I'd build up enough rapport, and you have to touch, by the way, if you haven't touched them yet at all, and you start doing this, there's a lot of sexual tension, which can be good, but can be too much sometimes.
Right.
So you have to break the touch barrier pretty early on, and that just means, like, you know, touching her on their arm every once in a while in a really light way while you're talking. Doesn't mean anything serious. It means keeping your hand on her for no more than a few seconds, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah, right, right,
and then
right.
And then taking it away. I would start triangular gazing while she's talking to me. So this is important. If I did it while I was talking to her, it was really aggressive. So as soon as she started saying something, eventually I would start looking at her, you know, one eye, then I'd go to the other, and then I look down at her mouth while she's talking, and I just kind of sit there doing that while she's talking.
Uh-huh.
And usually she'd start to trail off, because she starts to do the same thing back to me. And it's really
right.
Hard to look at somebody and talk while you're doing that.
Right.
So she would start to look back, and automatically she started to lean in almost every time. And she would sort of gaze more at my mouth and go back up between my eyes, and I would say these words, almost verbatim every time. I would go, "It's okay." And she would say, what's okay? What do you mean? What do you mean what's okay? And I would go, you can kiss me. I want to kiss you too. It's okay. And that was, I tested that over time to figure out which one would get me the highest sort of conversion here.
Right.
Which one would work the best. And if I didn't say, it's okay, I want to do it too, it didn't work as well. If I just said, you can kiss me, it was too cocky. Some girls would go, I don't want to kiss you. Even though they wanted to, they would say no.
Right.
Because it was filling my ego too much.
Right.
So I found at the end of the day, if I just said those words, it's okay, you can kiss me, I want to kiss you too.
That's great.
You know, it's all right. And then almost always she would lean in and kiss me, you know, like almost immediately. And I just, it was such a classic, amazing, you know, thing to say. Just made the first kiss the easiest thing ever. And once I had that in my back pocket, I could try other stuff just in case, you know, if something else didn't work, I could always fall back on that one, you know.
That's great.
It always worked, so it was pretty great. And that was, you know, that's sort of a piece of gold that I had there.
You know, I have heard a lot of people talk about triangular gazing, but your description of it was maybe the clearest one that I've ever heard, and a way to use it, you know, how to use it in specific, because it sort of seems like it sort of seems formulaic and simple, but the way you describe it kind of puts it into a context, and I think that's very interesting. I've not heard it described that well. That's very cool, and I love the it's okay thing. That's like cinematic, you know. It's like a line out of a movie, but it's obviously not. You know, it's just
I mean, even if it was, it'd be okay. You know, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, right. It's okay. Yeah, sure.
it's just one of those moments where, you know, at that point, anything that stands in the way of you, both of you, and your desire to kiss each other needs to go away. You know.
Yes. Right.
And I really feel that way.
My old business partner Mike, he used to do that all the time. He used to do triangular gazing, but and he had a tremendous amount of success with it, and I never could understand it myself. But just couldn't believe it. So the other thing I want to ask you, so just real quick, like the second date, the third date, you know, are you taking maybe you collect information on the first date and then you take that with you into the second and third date and kind of do things, structure things in and around those two dates that have to deal with her, what you guys have perhaps established some rapport on? Or do you have a kind of set thing that you do then? What's your take on the second and third date?
Stephen, do you mind if before I answer that, I run to the restroom real quick?
Go ahead.
I know it's not normal, but I can mark down the time if you want me to, so you know where this mess up is.
It's okay. I'll be quiet and I'll be able to see it.
Okay, cool. Sorry about that. I'll come back and I'll.
Go ahead.
You may have to restate the question though when I get back. That's okay.
That's fine.
Cool. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, Stephen?
Yeah.
Okay, I do remember the question. If you want me to go ahead and go to it.
Yeah, just dive in, and I'll cut this out. Just before you start talking, give it about a 3-second pause. It'll help me to just find it and have a clear way to cut.
Cool. So yeah, one of the things that I do a lot whenever I am going on sort of the second and third and fourth dates with people after the first one, and you know, depending on how the first one ended, if it ended with something that was a little, you know, that wasn't sexual or just like kind of like a hey, good night or whatever, or for whatever reason, I definitely made sure to pace things over time, and I'm a big fan personally of text messaging, and I love it.
Cool, yeah.
I love the power of being able to say, you know, to sort of pop up in her mind, sort of randomly throughout the day. And I had a series of things that I would just, you know, I didn't text the same thing to every girl or anything like that. But there are definitely some types of texts that girls can, that when a girl gets them, she's sort of called to respond to them in a really positive way, I found. And, you know, they're not cutesy texts. They're not like, oh, I was thinking of you, you know, because we only hung out one time, and I don't really want to jump into the relationship too fast. So it was kind of a big thing in my mind at the time. So what I would do is I would text sort of more banter-ish type things, like lighthearted, fun stuff. And I just assumed that every time I see a girl, if she goes away for a little while, like maybe a day or maybe even a couple hours, and comes back, that we have to start back from the beginning. You don't start where you left off. You don't start back in the deep connection. You don't walk up to her and start talking about serious stuff. You don't keep trying to build deep rapport over text or over the phone. And the reason why I don't do that is because if I build deep rapport over text or over the phone and she starts to have that emotional association and connection with me, I can't be there to anchor that to touch. And that's a big problem. So if I, you know, what I mean by that, just to be more clear, is that if I'm in front of someone and I'm making a really strong emotional connection, if I'm touching them in some kind of an intimate way, just like a, you know, hand on their arm or holding their hand or something while I'm doing that, then that deep emotional association and that trust that's built gets associated with her trust in me touching her. Mm. Now, if I build all that stuff over the phone, there's no touch. And so the next time I see her, there's a really strange physical awkwardness that will come across in your interaction, in my interactions, and will in everyone's interactions. And the reason why is because that anchor wasn't there. They didn't get to anchor that trust to the physical touch. And so a lot of guys will build this deep rapport over the phone or something and talk to her afterwards and then meet up with her, and then all of a sudden she'll be kind of pulled away and they won't know why. And they're like, what's going on here? I thought we got along so well, and, you know, I don't know, I thought that we had a really deep, serious conversation. And they'll be like, well, screw you, you know? I feel kind of hurt.
Right.
And so I don't do any of that stuff. I keep things very light when I'm not there, unless she comes to me with a problem. You know, if she comes to me with a problem, she wants to talk to me about it, then I drop everything and I'm pretty open, and I totally do whatever I need to do, you know? Mm. So over the next couple of days, if it's going to be, I very rarely would hang out the very next day, unless it was like something amazing.
Right.
You know, because that's sort of what you do when you're ramping up to be monogamous with somebody. And at the time when I dated, most of them when I dated, I was polyamorous. So
right.
Not only did I have other women that I needed to see, I, you know, and they all knew about each other, by the way. They all knew about each other ahead of time, just to clarify that. If they didn't like it and they weren't okay with it, I wouldn't date them. And so I would have things to do or whatever, but if it was just one girl, I was tempted just to jump straight into a relationship and see her every day for the next whatever amount of time. But I had to sort of take some restraint. So I would say, hey, let's hang out a little bit later on in the week when things slow down for me again, right? So I'd set up that same night, I would always set up the date for the next time. So that was really key for me. It made things so much easier. I know you're already on a high point. You know, it was all this trust and this connection and stuff that was already there. I didn't have to reset or anything. I'm going from that space of I trust you, you trust me, let's meet up again. I like this, right? And if you don't do that and you're doing it later on, you could call her up. She could have just gotten, you know, just gotten the news that her parents got in a car accident, you know, and she's like wrecked, or maybe one of her friends just yelled at her, or her boss just yelled at her. You know, so you don't know her mental state whenever you ask her, and it could absolutely affect how she responds. So I like to lock down the date for the next time, just loosely. You know, say like, you know, hey, if you're not doing anything later on this week, before I even leave the first date, if you're not doing anything later on this week, I'd love to hang out again. And she's like, okay, cool, sounds good. And I'd set it up right then. So every time that I'd meet up with her, I'd set up the next date at the end of that current date. And that was really crucial for me. But as far as where I went from there, after that, things were sort of more open for me after I got the whole spectrum in line. If I missed anything, like say she'd never seen me in a social situation during the daytime, I try to play that in and like add that into the mix so that she can see me in that scenario.
Right.
But if not, that's not a big deal. You know, I would just try to add it on later on. But I tried to hit up all those. I tried to hit my social activity at the time, and then whether or not it was day or night, and whether or not it was an intimate setting or it was a very, very open setting. I tried to mix all those up and get every combination. And
gotcha.
So if I got all those combinations, then I would go straight into whatever everyone else would like to do, which is like meet up and have dinner if I wanted to, or cook her dinner, or she would cook me dinner, or you know, we'd go see a movie. Anything after that point, you can pretty much, it's free, it's open range for you. You know, because you've gotten out of the way the things that were really important, you know, the things that were not normal, things that everyone doesn't jump to. So you allow yourself a lot of sort of flexibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I would do. I mean, at that point, I like to keep things sort of light and fun, but you know, I would keep things within the realm of whatever it is I wanted to do. But at that point, I started to use things from our conversation into the interactions as well. Like in the first date or whatever, first hanging out, if she told me that when I immediately met her before the first date, she told me she really loved Batman for some weird reason.
Right.
Which she did.
Right.
You know, if she said that, then I wouldn't bring her to a Batman themed whatever or do anything having to do with Batman at all on the first date. I wouldn't bring it up at all, pretty much. But on the second date, I would. On the second date, after I've gone past all of the, you know, initial deep rapport and everything too, now it's okay for me to show her that she's very special to me. Because before she goes into deep rapport with me and before I really connect with her, she's really like a lot of other girls. You know, there's no real reason to like her and to show her a special treatment yet.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I think she's cool, of course, and I'm hanging out with her, but there's no real reason for me to give her amazing special treatment. So after that, I might go, hey, look, come here and make it really vague, like kind of like you were talking about before. I'll meet you here at this time, wear this, you know? And it was like, you know, some like Batman grand opening or something. Or like, you know, the original Batmobile or something is there. You know,
right,
hey,
right.
I'll check it out, take photos, and we laugh. And, you know, it's like things that are kind of date-y. Like, you know, stuff you do for people that you really care about. And you can do that on the second, third, and fourth and fifth date. And I really encourage you to do that, actually. I encourage you to take things from your conversation you have with her during the deep rapport concepts and reinvent those, recreate those in a sort of date environment.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great stuff. That's great stuff.
Yeah. If it's Batman, then it might be a little weird, but...
Right. But if she does, we've already got a few ideas on the list here.
Exactly. Actually, no. I know where the original Batmobile is.
I was going to say, that would actually be pretty cool. You can meet there and then go somewhere else, you know.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's in Tallahassee, Florida, so it's going to be a bit of a drive.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, it takes a little while to get there.
Yeah, Tallahassee. I've been there.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, your business, and what you offer guys, and sort of what you're, how people can learn more from you.
Sure. Well, I have a book that I've authored that I'm very... proud of and very happy to release. It's called The Tao of Badass, which is a very funny sort of ironic name considering that Taoism is not about ego and
right.
You know, saying I'm badass is kind of egotistical. But but yeah, The Tao of Badass is basically the way of the path that I took to not just be good with women. I don't, you know, I never really had the idea that I wanted to be just good with women. I wanted to be a total badass with women. I wanted to be able to have scenarios that, and basically I wanted to know how to do whatever I needed to do in any scenario to make whatever outcome I wanted so that I could stop worrying about that stuff. You know, I wanted to be able to let go and know that I'm not neglecting something and that I'm not letting things sort of fall apart. And the reason why I wrote that book is because, you know, in the beginning there was no real guide for me to be really good with women. I mean, there are guys who teach me to do one thing or another, so I really put it together so that it was all the essential things that guys would need to know in order to be really, really good with women. And I really had the focus in that book is whether you're going to be dating multiple women and that's your goal, or, you know, sort of getting women sort of out of the way, you know what I mean? Like dating lots of women and getting that sort of out of your system before you settle down, or whether or not, you know, in my case, really, it was preparing myself to attract my future wife, really.
Right.
You know, and know that I wouldn't fumble around with that. That's sort of, those were the sort of reasons why I developed the book, and it's great, and it's for sale now as well, and definitely check it out if you get a chance. I think that it'll be a lot in line with the things that you teach, and from what I've seen from you, and seeing you speak and whatnot, it's not the same material, of course, it's very different material, but it is within the same integrity.